good story at the beginning, we're learning about someone we think we have nothing in common with, right? That is, doesn't even speak the same language as us, maybe, that lives in a whole nother place, that is in a life situation of conflict, for example, that we can never imagine because we don't have that lived experience. But by the end of the story, we realize we're just like them. And that pull towards the universal is that challenge, but that's what is at the heart of a good story.
What's going on, everybody? Great to have you back for another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast, where I interview the world's best storytellers about how they craft the stories they tell. On this week's episode, my guest is Jake Warga. Jake is an award-winning radio journalist and contributor to NPR, Public Radio International, and American Public Media. His stories have been featured on programs such as All Things Considered and a little-known program called This American Life. On top of making his own stories, Jake also teaches storytelling as a lecturer at Stanford University. Some of his courses include Your American Life, where students produce their own audio documentaries, and also an environmental history course where students look at how stories told through photography, film, podcasts, and writing have shaped our understanding of history. In this conversation, Jake and I discuss how one of his first ever radio stories ended up on This American Life, the three layers of a well-told story, and how the brevity, clarity, and visual nature of writing for radio can teach us all a thing or two about how to tell better stories. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jake Warga. All right, so should we jump into it?
Sure.
All right, let's do it. Jake Warga, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It is great to have you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah. So Jake, I'd love to start by hearing a little bit about your background. And how did you arrive into this wild world of journalism and audio documentary where I know a good part of your heart lies?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's always the answer of how I got into it. I've struggled to get out of it for so long too, which may be a whole nother story. But to at least give you the milestones of the random trajectory that I've been on, I did graduate school in London for visual anthropology, which I thought would be great for radio. I didn't, actually. I wanted to do documentary film and whatnots, but
All right.
Yeah, but I was a little too cheap to buy a camera, too, at the time. So I did the best thing next to that, of course, which is audio recording. And I had done, before graduate school, a couple of projects back in Seattle. And one of them got picked up by This American Life, and then another one got picked up by a travel show that won all these awards. And all that fermented while I was in grad school, so that when I came back, I had really nothing to do, but I was offered some radio gigs, as we used to call podcasting, which is, for example, the first editor said, all right, go from Seattle to LA to go see your grandma, but don't fly and don't drive. Call us when you get here. And that started like this travel thing. And I asked him, I was like, well, what's the story? He says, just go ahead and do that. And sure enough, I don't know, the microphone or myself or that combination made a bit of a magnet for stories. And of course, taking Greyhounds, you're going to meet people. And
absolutely,
especially now that are like people on the no-fly list, they're great people to talk with. In fact, oh, now I'm jumping ahead, but
no worries.
To give you a preview of where I'm going.
Yeah, preview it.
Yeah, I took a bunch of students to a Greyhound station in Oakland, and we sat there for hours collecting stories from people, and they and I learned a lot about life on the Greyhound and the sort of transient natures of cities and meth. So it was fun. But to go back to my original stories.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, because I don't do linear.
That's totally fine. But right. you seem to gloss over the fact a little bit that like You went, so visual anthropology, then you did a couple radio stories, and one of your first stories lands on like the biggest radio show in the country, This American Life. I don't know what its stature was back then, but how does that happen?
Oh, yeah, it was easier to break into, I want to say, in that any fish jumping in the pond at the time was a big fish because the pond was kind of small.
And what year
are
we
called
talking?
Radio. Oh, good God. I guess 2001.
Okay.
2000, yeah. And the transom.org is basically, they helped me out a lot. And their whole transom is that little window above a door that basically journalists used to throw their manuscripts over the transom to try to get onto an editor's desk because the front door to them was pretty much locked. Hmm. And it, I think that's still, I mean, the transom website, it's the first website to earn a Peabody in history. And it's really exists to help independent producers break into the industry. And so they provide a lot of mentoring. And what I had done a story about homeless street kids and their dogs in Seattle, and I sent that to Transom, and Jay Allison really liked it, and I sent my photos with it. And I said, hey, I got this other story. I don't quite know what it is or to do about it, but I had recorded a friend. I was en route to West Africa, of course, as one might.
As one does, yes.
Yeah. I basically told a friend in college that when after we graduated that I would visit her in the Peace Corps, and not really appreciating what that meant. And I had never really left the United States, and I was about 23, 24, and so that was my first trip out, and whew, we'll get back to that. But that was my second story, which is a non-narrated piece about the Peace Corps experience. Hmm. And that was really fun. And actually, the Peace Corps used that for a recruiting tool for a while, which...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was great. They sent me like a calendar for the next 6 years every year. Yeah. And anyway, so en route, I had heard a friend of mine who had attempted suicide in my old college town. So I went down there and pinned a mic on him with my mini disc recorder. And we just sat on a bench for hours. And my basic question was why? Mm-hmm. And what I've learned is that journalism is not coming out with answers. Reporting is, but journalism is a place where you ask questions, and then in the end, if you're lucky, you come out with more questions or better questions. Mm-hmm. And I did a mix of that interview, mixed it with some music. Moby was very popular at the time.
Yeah.
And sent that to Transom, and I ended up bumping my original story because they wanted to post that. And then Sarah Val was the guest editor, and so she took it to the show.
Wow.
Yeah.
In preparation for the interview today, I heard that piece, which is, it's a very powerful, very beautiful piece. And I was curious, you know, it's a very... For the listeners, you know, it's a very sensitive piece in which Jake and his friend are sitting on this bench, like he said, and you're asking, Jake, you're asking very challenging questions to your friend, and you can tell that you're coming from a very loving place as a friend as you ask those questions and as you listen to him. And I was curious, like, when you were just starting to get into radio, when you go to your friend who's just had this, you know, very intense moment in his life, and you say, hey, can I slap a mic on you? like, are you thinking in that moment, ooh, this could be a good story? Are you, what was your thinking in that story?
Yeah, I don't know. I had to do something. And a microphone is an extension of your curiosity. It's what we might call in academics now a tool of inquiry, mm-hmm. right? That we use it to ask what we want to ask, maybe as an excuse, just like a lens is a way to capture a place. Photography is, I like to think, capturing the world as it is, but art is capturing it how you see it and being able to share it so that it's unique. And yeah, I went and clipped a mic on him. And by the way, tech thing, clip-on microphones are horrible quality. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that at the time. And he kept dangling it, something on his shirt. And it, anyways, the, yeah. But what it does is you kind of forget it's there. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. A lens tends to be obvious. It's between you and the person you're speaking with. And interviews start as interviews, but really they're invitations to conversations.
Right.
And hopefully the tech goes away. And you know it's there, but you're talking to one person, and that one person's talking to you. And that's the heart of all good stories, at least I enjoy on the radio, which is talking to one person, and you're privileged to sort of be there. And you, the reporter, you, the producer, you, the storyteller, however you want to pronoun yourself, you become the listener. And for that moment, I was kind of scared. And I didn't know how do you talk about these things? Well, sometimes you can just pull out a microphone, a recorder, and say, well, let's not do this for me. Let's do this for the recorder. But then in the end, that's the stepping stone to getting closer to someone. Hmm. And yeah, you can say it's about doing a radio story, but that's only what it's about. What it's really about is sharing a moment and trying to understand something. And again, I don't know why he did it, but I wanted to know, at least get closer to understanding. Mm-hmm. And if you want sort of a sad follow-up to that, I became very good friends with his brother, who I had not met until that time, basically over cleaning Brian's apartment. And yeah, we both had a void to fill, and him a brother and me a friend, and we became very close friends. Then a few years later, he jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. And this time I was actually a little more angry, right? And death and me have got, unfortunately, quite a long relationship starting in my 20s. And I wanted to confront it, and so I went and did a story about the Golden Gate Bridge and the history of suicides, and it was called 4 Seconds, because that's how long it takes once you jump to hit the water. And I looked at Phil's life, and that ended up airing on All Things Considered.
And were these projects just ones that helped you process those moments?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did them for me at first because I had this question and I was scared and I wanted to know both why, but also how, and all those questions that not just journalists ask. And journalism is great for telling us the who, what, when, how, where. Really good journalism explores the why. And that's what I was exploring. And so if you want to say that the story was about the bridge, but it was really about Phil. And I wanted to share Phil's life. I wanted to, I think as I said in the epilogue to the first This American Life story, which is I wanted to take something from death. Death, I was getting a little annoyed that it kept taking things from me. And so and I think that's really the approach that I took. Mm-hmm. And there were funny moments too. Like I was sitting on the bridge writing and recording, and then a policeman comes up to me, assuming I was about to jump, because why else would you be sitting sad writing in a notebook on the bridge? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there, and I mention that because To tell a sad story, to tell a true story, you have to tell a real story. And Jaundice, which is that happy face, sad face combo icon that's above every theater, it's well known that to understand tragedy, you must pair it with comedy.
Hmm. Why is that?
You'd have to ask the Greeks, and everything is stolen from Plato, which is basically the craft and the art of storytelling between Plato and Socrates. It was so all known. And, you know, there's, I guess, and that's the thing. When you talk, you hear interviews with Ira Glass or any professional storytellers, they'll give you little nuggets of advice. And I sort of figured out a lot of those go back towards Aristotle even, which is kind of fun. But the idea is that that's closer to real life.
Yeah.
And a sad sob story, a portrait of a tragedy, doesn't really have the emotional weight, I think, or the honesty of the struggle to get to where that person lives and the comic consequences that ensued really help set the stage.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I know even in the piece about your friend, Brian, was his name, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Brian, there are those moments in the story of comedy or levity when you're chasing the train and putting the coins on the train tracks. Yeah, I can kind of track those to your stories. But you said something that really caught my attention, which is you feel like the best stories, you know, you go in seeking the answer or some understanding to a question. But that your goal as a storyteller is not necessarily to answer that question, but to come out with better questions. So for you in these stories that we're referring to, can you provide some insight into what those better questions you came out of the stories were? Were you going into them saying like, I just need to understand why they did this? And then what came out?
Yeah, the first question when you hear of a death is how, mm-hmm. right? Which is kind of curious. And I did look a lot at the anthropology of death and I look cross-culturally. And that was one of my curiosities, of course. But I mean, it's pretty natural, which is like, well, how someone died, because I want to avoid that.
Right.
Right.
It's right. Like,
electrocuted in the shower. Good to know. Right. I will stop doing that practice that. Right. And that's why when you look at the Darwin Awards, you've heard of those.
I've heard of them, but I don't really know what they are.
Yeah. The tragicomic ways in which people meet their end.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And those are, they're sad and funny and that sort of combo. But to me, the honorary Darwin Awards are the better ones. The people who ought to be dead, right? Because they did something either really stupid or really common. Mm. And you want to take note of those in your own life.
Right.
But yeah, the second question is why? And you can... Let me jump ahead. And after I was finished with grad school, moved back to Seattle, I had the travel bug in many senses. Mm-hmm. Antibiotics will take care of some, but I also wanted to see more of the world. And I had gone to West Africa as my first trip after a little stint to Europe. And I had gone over there on a cargo ship because I thought, well, flying's too quick and I don't want jet lag, whatever the heck that is. And I had all these adventures and I spent the next 10, 15 years, I think, traveling the world. I've been to over 50 countries, reporting for different shows, rarely on assignment, but I would also do tourism bureau work, doing photo campaigns for different countries or PR companies. And while I was doing
would you just like, I want to go here, and then you just send a cold email to some tourism bureau and be like, I'm coming, let me do something for you.
let me bring you back again to the glory days when podcasting was called radio and also travel writing was called a career. And there were websites like travelwriters.com or something, Media Kitty, all these resources where they would put out press releases, the companies would put out, or, you know, campaigns would publish and invite writers to go on junkets.
Okay,
it was shameless. I mean, my first junket came via NPR. NPR said, oh, we can't take free trips, are you kidding, we're journalists, but Jake will do it. And so I would do that and then air the story on NPR. So yeah, that really should have alleviated any of their conscious guilt on that. But yeah, it was pretty shameless, but there was no other way to go. Mm-hmm. And so I would justify it by going on these junkets, maybe writing up a little blurb for a couple websites or something. But then I would pull out the mic and do my own story that I thought interesting. So there were plenty in Australia, for example. And then I learned about East Timor, which was under military control with the UN supervision. And so I hopped on a military flight out there and then did stories. The Australian PR company, for example, was not so happy about that. Or the rental car that I may have crashed. But it was good because I was honoring my own curiosity. I thought there's something going on here, and I want to know more. But my ignorance about a subject, I sort of try to adopt the naivete of a listener as well, and then I research as best I can and talk with people, get dirty, go and learn what's going on, and I will never know the whole answer of what's happening in a place. Mm-hmm. I can provide a moment. I can provide an insight into what's happening in a greater sense through something small or one person. And that's the tree for the forest approach. Mm-hmm. And that's at the heart of all good stories, nonfiction and fiction, I guess. But yeah, and jump way fast forward to the present, I now teach storytelling at Stanford, mainly in the form of podcasting. And I produce the State of the Human podcast. I'm the managing editor of that, which is a student-run podcast released 2 a quarter based on a theme very similar to This American Life. And as a alum, you can speak to all the thrills you had in producing
absolutely
stories at the Storytelling Project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I learned a lot there. And my recent guest was Zandra Clark, who was also a producer back in the day on the Stanford Storytelling Project show.
Yeah,
so we're well represented.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's okay, so that brings us to the present, and what I was sort of referring to is that there's really 3 points to any story a student produces I produce or anyone produces that I want to get. There's what's it about, what's it really about, and the meaning of life. So what that means is what's it about? So you go in with a general idea, mm-hmm. right? Here's the forest, basically. So for example, I went to Ethiopia on a research trip documenting this one program to get rid of this eye disease, which, yeah, that was fun. Mm-hmm. But along the way, I went and did my own pieces, and one was understanding poverty.
Okay. Right? Big topic.
Pretty big topic, right? Yeah. But I go in starting with, I basically say, I'm going to Ethiopia in this one town to look for the Ark of the Covenant. Right.
Okay.
From just like the movie. And I play the soundtrack and we're coming in on a prop plane, just like in the movie. Right. And it's really fun. And this was an All Things Considered story. And I really enjoy it because it brings the listener in on that wonderful opening hook that I'm going to go find the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's what it's about. That's what I'm looking for. Now, what is it really about? Well, I go to this one town and I find the Ark. It's actually in the Lonely Planet guide. It's not that hard. No one can see it because your face will melt, just like in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But around it, And through the story, I started learning a little bit about the people there that live in this town and how poor they are, and look a little bit about the history of food aid into Ethiopia, and really questioning what is the nature of God. Because that's what the Ark embodies, right? No one can look at it because no mortal can see the eye of God, because we just melt. It's just TMI, I guess. And it's locked up and no one can see it, mainly for that reason. But also, it was a question of proof versus faith. I mean, sometimes proof can deny faith. And I talked with a German archaeologist, kid you not, at the site, you know, about... He's looking to say that, no, this is not possible date-wise that the Ark is here. And I was like, oh, but you don't tell that to the people walking around. It was Lent, so they circle the church where the Ark is, who want to believe that the next life is going to be easier than this one. And yeah, and so that's basically, and the third point is that every story should tell me what is the meaning of life. Students kind of get a little pressured on that, but I remind them that
it's intense.
Yeah, that it doesn't have to be the encompassing, but rather we provide an insight, right? That it zooms into a universal, so that a good story at the beginning, we're learning about someone we think we have nothing in common with, right? That is, doesn't even speak the same language as us, maybe, that lives in a whole nother place, that is in a life situation of conflict, for example, that we can never imagine because we don't have that lived experience. But by the end of the story, we realize we're just like them. And that pull towards the universal is that challenge, but that's what is at the heart of a good story, is that. And that's what Ira Glass and This American Life, right? It's the ending is inevitable but unexpected in the way that we get there. And that actually comes from Aristotle, who says ending is surprising but inevitable. Anywho. the hope is that in that story, for example, that maybe the next question and that ambiguity that we're left with is, I know more about one place and maybe a little more about a topic, but that makes it even grayer, even a muddier zone. And then the question, yeah, what would I do in that situation is what I hope the listener does. And in a good story, at some point a mirror is held up to the reader, to the viewer, to the listener to say, hey, you're involved in this. What is, you know, if you've really hit that wonderful pathos, that feeling in something, that you inspire the consumer of the media to basically say, oh my God, I identify in a way. And that's what travel, you know, the root of the word travel comes from suffering.
Really?
Yeah. And I see suffering in a sense of travel as that horrible thing that narrows a gap between expectation and reality. And the same in a story is that we expect when we hear about someone so different than us that we would not have anything in common. But by the end, we discover that there is something in common, and that is empathy or humanity. No pressure.
So I want to unpack a little bit more of those. So like when... particularly on the meaning of life, when you say meaning of life, it doesn't necessarily need to be like, to be like, this is why we're here, or to be a good person, do this. It just has to touch on something universal, like some human quality that's universal that
yeah,
we
it
can
should
all
be
relate to.
Yeah, descriptive, not prescriptive, right? So that, and not to know the whole meaning of life, because again, then you'd melt.
Right?
You'd see too much and you'd disappear in a puff of empathy and wisdom, probably.
Yeah,
yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And the idea of a story is that we suffer. We go through a process of sharing one moment in a long trip, perhaps. And that trip can be an idea, even. And narrativizing research is a huge part of my job now. And talking with researchers, you know, who... will with great enthusiasm tell me about how exciting their research is, but I'm not excited, right? When they start to describe it. So it's like, Okay, well, let's take what you know, and don't give me any numbers, but let's just target that enthusiasm so that a layman, when listening, you know, non-scientists would, and that's what Radiolab's secret, of course, not so secret, is you take a scientific fact, not that first the Earth cooled kind of big question or the Big Bang, but you take one part of that, one question, and then you find all the people that helped in asking that question and maybe even coming up with an answer, but, you know, respecting the scientific process, which is that they can only arrive at theories, that in a part of the scientific process, of course, is that it has to be open to being disproven.
Right.
So therefore, firm answers are always questionable to begin with. But I probably departed from your original question, which is, yes, an insight into one person's choice.
Yeah.
In that one moment when a character, and we use the term character even if it's a real person, because I don't like to use subject, because that gets us close to object, which objectification or orientalism, there's a lot of fraught associations with that, of course. But to go and talk with someone and then get their, you know, get it in the language of the listener, and then we get a lot closer to that universal, which is the meaning of life. Mm. And there is no one meaning. We have to start collecting little bits along the road of life.
Mm-hmm. And when and you're...
Yeah.
And so whether it's when you're in the pitch process or whether it's while you're on the ground, at what point do you know what it's about, what it's really about, and the meaning of life to your story? Is that something you're constantly discovering as you're speaking to those characters? Or is that something you go out to the story with an idea in mind and you kind of test that hypothesis as you go?
Yes.
Second one?
I have no idea. it changes every time. And the adage is that, you know, you have a story once it's the story you didn't think you had. Or the story that you wanted, right? So that if you arm yourself, and this is a big difference, and that's a lot of what I wrestle with here at Stanford, being kind of a research bias or, you know, oriented university, which is, I have a theory, I want to go out and prove or disprove. That's not storytelling. That's science.
Right.
Right. Even when you use social science, which to me is a contradiction. But you have, say, a concern. You, even if you're jumping on headlines, and if there's something really heavy in the national narrative at the moment, so for example, school shootings, gun violence, is constant.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, it spikes at different times, and then the tragic brevity of the news cycle is that we light a few candles and then say we should do something, nothing happens, right? And that repetitive nature of the current sort of model of media is, well, it's not really effective in change. And I'm not saying that all stories have an advocacy angst to them, but the success of The Daily, for example, the New York Times, The Daily, is, you know, we've definitely attributed it to, which is to take one headline and then tell us how we got there. Mm. And that's context. And that's the root of story, which is historia. In any romance language, story was the same as history. So when you ask anyone a history, you're actually asking a story. And haven't had that for so long. We've been decontextualized from so much national news or international news that we go in with that question in mind. Mm-hmm. But the challenge of that forest, and there's one idea where you come in with this, there's this, I can't, it's so, right? Big question.
So big.
Yeah, say, all right, we'll find a tree. Mm-hmm. We know the forest, yeah, you want to hide behind trees sometimes in that forest of that topic. But the challenge was, can we find a tree? And what we did was went to a paintball obstacle course in San Jose, a bunch of students and I, and We interviewed the parents sitting on the benches watching their kids out on an obstacle course shooting each other with paintball. Wow. About the nature of shootings and violence. Right?
Right.
Yeah, it seems like prime areas. And we pushed the parents to really question a lot of their statements too, right? Say, oh, well, it gets them out of the house instead of playing shooter violent video games. And they're like, what? It sounds like they're enacting them. They're not actually. But
right.
Yeah, and that's a way where we're not going to find out, hey, what's the answer to? It's not a solution-based question. Mm-hmm. And if anyone prods you for a solution, it often means that they've not understood the problem. Mm. And that's a policy tendency in journalism and storytelling should actually push against this binary reductionism, right? This thinking that there's a left, there's a right, there's a good or an evil. Every student that I throw into the deep end of whatever topic they are curious about, they come back more confused. And to me, and eventually they realize that is the success, which is nothing is that simple. Hmm. And to be able to navigate that gray area in between that space and to basically share in the journey of asking that question becomes the story.
Yeah, I love that. And so when you're scripting out a story or you're putting some structure to that, is there kind of, do you think the stories that you try to do or the ones that you really like have a kind of slow reveal where they pull back the layers of, you think you're taking your audience on that same journey maybe of discovery that you went on, which is they first think it's about something, and then they realize, oh, wait, no, it's about way more than that. And then you deliver that kind of, this is why you're listening at the end. And
yeah.
And if I could piggyback one more on that question, it seems to me like in radio, more so than probably the form I work in, which is documentary filmmaking, oftentimes that meaning of life takeaway is more explicit. And so I'm wondering if you see that as well or and why that is.
Sure.
There's like five backwards questions for you there.
Yeah, no, that's fine. as you know, I just like just go down a road until someone stops me. But video, the medium and the message, right? I don't want to stand on my lecture podium here, but Marshall McLuhan, right, famously put this question out there in the 70s, I think, and I'm not that old, but he was saying, you know, the medium shapes the message, and that if, for example, it's a video, it's a respect for the viewer. Is there as much respect for a viewer as there is for a podcast listener, or there is for a novel reader, or there is for a newspaper article, or for a billboard, or a bubblegum wrapper, right? Every medium itself will shape the message. And there's precedent in place. And because it's video, you want imagery, right? The story itself always lies in the bed, which is not how people say something, but what they say. And that happens in the audio. And most people, at least back in the day when there were television sets on, listened to them. They didn't watch because it was sort of on in the background. It's that background noise that its television was great for. Documentaries, hopefully you have a more captive viewership. I think a lot about Vice Media, for example.
Yeah.
There's been some fantastic stories, sort of like hipsters parachuting into places, sort of framing.
Right.
Which is adopting, again, that naivete of the viewer. Say, yeah, I'm in the Belgian Congo. Of course, yeah. Why? Right. But what are you going to discover along the way? Oh, it's Africa, right? I think so. Well, they must be in difficult situations. Probably, right? Those are just horrible expectations that a viewer might have. Now, back to that, a listener, It is so intimate. A podcast is not a broadcast. A podcast is speaking to one person at a time, with earbuds usually, which you can't get any more intimate than that as a medium goes, because, and even Hourglass says, radio is the most visual medium, right, in that you have to describe something just enough to keep going in the story, and a lot of narrative nonfiction writers, especially when writing on craft, will talk about that, that the imagination is so profound, and that gets us a lot closer to the ultimate goal of any story, right? Which is to trigger some empathy in a situation, in a place, in a person, or even in the listener or viewer themselves, right? And you can go back to the Greeks to say, oh, is it ethos plus pathos gets us to a point of empathy, which is generally what we teach in rhetoric, which is, yeah, here's a fact, a statistic.
Yeah.
So what? And that's another way of framing about, really about. The about is the so. The really about is the so what. Mm-hmm. So you have the statistic, right? So for example, Ebola outbreaks. I know this, again, is resurging in the DRC when they had a election. So they use that as, say, well, we shouldn't have gathering places. Like, yeah, that's a public health concern. What's it really about, though? We don't know. And maybe it's really about, and this is a journalist or a reporter will call an angle, right? Say, hey, you have this big idea. How can you enact it on a very small stage, be it a podcast or a video or even an article, if people still read those, right? To say, how can we perform this question? Mm-hmm. How can we set the scene? Is the DRC, for example, there's our backdrop, but what do we need to know about it? Well, it's a highly developed capital. It's very modern or urban. It's like, oh shoot. Okay. I thought it was jungle. Right. So we have to establish that if that's relevant to the story. And then we bring in a character and we hear through them. In fact, hey, you know, maybe it's about, why is there no clean water, for God's sakes?
Right.
Right. And then the story sort of starts to follow that. And we go to someone's area and we say, hey, what happened? Political corruption. Mm-hmm. Really? I thought it was just natural resource availability question, you know, global health policy question. No, it was actually about this. It's like, oh, my God, and you start to follow that thread. Mm-hmm. And that's the journey of the story. And I have no idea what your original question was.
Well, that's totally fine, because I wanted to argue with one of something that you said.
Yes.
Which is, I have also heard before from, I think Ira Glass says it in the Stanford Storytelling Project, where radio is the main medium that we work in, is that podcasting is the most intimate medium for storytelling. Mm-hmm. I believe it's video. I believe documentary films, which is what I'm trying to do, is the most intimate. And my argument would be, you know, I love podcasts. I listen to podcasts all the time. But usually when I'm listening to podcasts, I'm also doing something else. I'm multitasking, and it's like in my ear while I'm running, or it's in my ear while I'm cooking, something like that. Whereas when I'm watching a film, like, I am devoting 100% of my attention to it. And I know that might just be me, but I would contend that video, in the way that it demands your active participation, increases the intimacy of that story being delivered to the audience.
Wasn't video a gimmick to have blinky lights and pretty things to get you to listen to something?
I would say no. And my example for that, which I've talked about a couple times on this podcast, is a film out right now called On Her Shoulders, where I feel like so much of the meaning of the film is when nothing is being said and it's a facial expression, or, you know, that's just captured on camera, or these quiet moments where just seeing someone or seeing how they look at each other when no words are spoken.
Well, those are definitely atmospherics. But yes. What do they provide for context?
What do you mean?
Well, meaning, what are they saying by not saying something?
So,
and I don't mean silence, but rather, also there's cultural relativism involved too, right? To watch someone think is allowing us the space to contemplate what they're contemplating. I think is what you're suggesting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that beforehand a situation was established, a question was posed, a character has to deal with something or make a choice, and then we stare at them as they think about it, right? Because in the idea of that is that they become us, right? And that's what gets us closer to intimacy, right? And connection is to say, oh, my God, how do you decide what to do? And not just, we'll be right back after this sponsorship break, right? Or commercial time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see how that, and that's why, like, A24 Productions and a lot of independent, well, they would say independent, production companies right now deal with a lot of atmospheric visuals, right? Especially the new wave of suspense horror films that are really, I think they're art films. You know, The Pretty Thing Inside the House, or these, I forget the name, but...
I would say on the idea of like active versus passive participation on the part of the audience, you know, one of the things I love about video is I do think it requires more active participation, but in some ways it's also a downfall of the medium because I see the trend, especially in video journalism, is moving away from longer, more in-depth pieces to a place where most newsrooms are like cutting video. If anything, they're becoming shorter. They're just playing for social media with like big block letters coming up on them. Whereas podcasting is going longer and more narrative.
Yeah. And we hope that the, you know, the video platforms will also follow that antidote lead. And I call it an antidote, which is we've been so tragically cut down. And I stopped producing for a lot of shows when it used to be, you know, could you do a 12-minute story? I was like, sure. And then an 8 or 7 and then a 6. And now ATC's big slot, I think, is 4.5 minutes.
What's ATC?
All Things Considered on NPR, you know, the flagship news magazine. And it's just not cost efficient for a producer to do that because you get paid by broadcast hour. But also, I think it doesn't. Not that time and content are related, right? That brevity is not always tragic, but when we define terms like storytelling versus reporting, reporting is here's a fact, right? Mm-hmm. And here's maybe, if we have time, what led to this fact, and that's it. And that's the turnaround rush. And unfortunately, the corporatized media, especially, you know, for-profit industry, perversely incentivizes a lot shorter content that the turnaround is quicker because it's longevity. It doesn't stay with us. And documentary films have always been, and now podcasts have been privileged to inhabit the space too, I think, of the same audience. Of that, which is the respect for depth. And depth is possible through time, of course, more time, but obviously not too long that we get bored. But also, it's a question of what do you wish to achieve in the medium you're working with? And intimacy definitely is not achieved always with the shorter pieces. And NPR is not journalism. NPR is news reporting. Right, This American Life, I would say, is more journalism, and it depends, again, how you would want to define journalism as being honest with yourself about what do I wish to accomplish and get across with this. And it's not a soapbox, it's not a broadcast, even though it may have terrestrial listenership, but the idea of a lot of things now is, yes, you select it, right? And Netflix or on Amazon, I watch a lot of the documentary shorts, especially, mm-hmm. you know, the Oscar-nominated channels. And I think, well, this is really cool,
yeah,
right? But even in the fiction, I feel like I've gotten more of a documentary out of the fiction shorts. Because you go to a place and you have, you know, local filmmakers making a local film, and how is that not a documentary? Right, if it's even a period piece, becomes an attempt to show us something that happened in the past in holding up relevance to a present moment. And that's, you know, StoryCraft for me, especially as now I'm going to be teaching as my second history course, using podcasts as a way of time traveling, I really appreciate.
Yeah.
But I do agree, I come from the film industry, but what I really enjoy, and I think what podcasts are so popular, to question the medium itself, yes, it's named after the pod, the iPod.
Yeah. Right?
And it's already a legacy term. They don't make iPods anymore, although I buy them on eBay when I need some because I love them. You can hit fast forward through your pocket. It's wonderful, and it doesn't tell you you have an email. And so, yeah, I'm a desired demographic, I guess you would say. But the idea is pod, right? And there are dangers with that too, that you're only listening to what you curate.
Yeah.
And you fetishize your own tastes. And that was a big concern when the podcast came out. But it hasn't changed. In fact, they went with the iPhone, the iPad, it's all about me, right? The self. And so for a lot of podcasts now, for producers, and for me especially, to speak personally, is that I want to demystify a lot of things. I used to live in Morocco, and I would do a lot of stories trying to demystify Islam or try to demystify North Africa, if I had to zoom out that far, right? To say the world is not what the news tells you. That's only part of it. Let's make it even more confusing by telling you what's really happening.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Ira Glass also, when he said radio is the most visual medium, he pauses and he says, that's bullshit, of course. But it sounds great.
Yeah, it does sound good. So I would.
And he does follow that with a qualifier. But people usually lop off the quote about there.
Yeah. So we have time for, I think, a couple more questions. So one I would like to pose to you, as someone who comes from a film background and as someone who probably teaches people who are interested at Stanford in storytelling in all forms, whether it's also video, maybe even theater, probably writers come to you. What are lessons that we can take from how, like, stories are told through sound on radio? How can we take some of those unique characteristics and apply it to the stories that we're telling in different mediums?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, these are highly transferable skills. Douglas Adams, who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which started as a radio show, and he worked in radio in the BBC. And he said, if you want to learn to be a good writer, work in radio. Because these are really transferable skills. And so, yes, often my courses, they're about producing a podcast. But guess what? They're not. They're really about how to use narrative tools in the craft of storytelling to explore something, to share something, to basically give a gift to someone, the journey of your discovery, the journey that you go in place, time, or idea, or sometimes all three, right? That, yeah, don't tell the enrolled students yet, but yeah, we produce a podcast, but it's the process, not the product. And yes, I tutor all sorts of people, all sorts of departments. Like I even worked with a global health course at the medical school last quarter, where through trying to make a story about a global issue, they actually were able to use those craft techniques to better understand their research question. And I go to writing and rhetoric courses where, yeah, I want to do a story about how AI is really great. It's like, that's not a story, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like an advertisement, which a lot of things around here do sound like, right? So say, all right, well, what about it? What do you think can be fixed? Or if you do that, what's broken? And a lot of technology questions, I sort of push students to question, like, you know, I supervise students over the summer where they go all around the world just trying to do different stories based on a grant system.
Is that the Braden Grant?
Yeah, the Braden Grant and their research question. Did you do one?
Yeah, I did one. I did one about a center for the blind in Sebastopol, California.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a really great experience.
What was the insight?
Oh man, this is probably
I guess it's a bad play on words, but
I'm trying to think here.
What was it really about?
It's been a long time, so I'm trying to recall the piece. Let me think.
All right, you work on that.
Okay, yeah.
I'll keep babbling.
Yeah, keep babbling.
But, yeah, because that's, we just had a Braden grantee go to school for the blind as well to look at echolocation about how we don't use our listening as much as we do our sight. See if she could echolocate and walked into a lot of walls in the process. But yeah, what was it really about is like, hey, do we have all these traits in that? It was about, you know, blind people at first, you know, the visually impaired even, but rather, no, it got us to something else to say, hey, do we have this superpower?
Yeah.
Right. And I don't mean, you know, not just dolphin kind of clicky things, but yeah, it was kind of fun. And blind, you know, to not see is the medium of radio and the medium of writing and novel writing. Feature essay writing. No one sees what's happening. You have to describe it. So in that way, the skill of being able to describe that with clarity and brevity is a writing skill. And that's what we teach in podcasting. And often with students is this weird tendency, which I totally understand, which is just to fatten up a paper. So much writing. And so little said,
right?
Right. And so when we teach podcasting, it's a great way to help writers, to help researchers even in their proposal hoops, to pare down to the essential. And only then, once you found that tree, to pull back out to the forest. You come in with a forest, you find a tree, and then you, through the tree, we can infer the larger picture, but you can't come in with that large picture.
And do you think that we are trained through school to fatten up papers and try to sound smart and use an unnatural voice and vocabulary just to try to like fake our way through getting good grades? Or where does that come from?
Well, that was a loaded question. Just play that back and there's your answers. But yeah, no, there. Okay, I'm not saying to poo-poo academies as a language, of course. It's an institution, and it's highly valid. And all the terminology and all the processes exist for a structure and for a reason, and sometimes, yes, for a bureaucracy. To navigate that bureaucracy, you must speak that language. And I know the hotkey on Word and Google Doc for strikethrough. Because it is the thing I use the most when I'm reviewing scripts, which is strike through. And it's like, you've said this twice in different ways, or you have one thing happens, you have one moment of realization from that. That's it. Action, reflection, pair it accordingly. Don't fact drop at the beginning. No one's going to care. They may know, but why should they care? So take one fact, pair it with a meaning, and then give us another fact. So no, these are great skills.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we look at a lot of essays, and I go into writing courses and say, you know, I'm not here to invert your inverted pyramid, but how can we engage a reader in using the tools of StoryCraft. And those are transferable. So even in video, video, right? And yeah, I love how you say film, which is again, legacy terminology.
Yep.
But somehow film, that term, and I'm sure Susan Sontag, a critical theorist, have a field day with this, right? Mm-hmm. Is that it's an elevation to an art form rather than as a medium of news, right? Versus video. Video is like YouTube, ew.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one of the
reasons. That's just the platform, right?
Yeah, that was one of the, I've been totally exploring how to talk about my work and using different terms because I felt like there is something about documentary filmmaking where it's like, I identify with the part of the craft, which is like, I want to tell a story with artistry, which feels so much different than like when I was working at the LA Times.
Yeah. The LA Times is fact driven, mm-hmm. right? A good personal story or emotive story is emotional driven. Emotionally right. driven, right? So the combination of those two, and again, that's logos plus pathos equals what, you know, it equals what a good story is. It equals a story. Mm-hmm. A fact is not a story. A feeling is not a story. A fact plus a feeling, that's a story.
So before we wrap up, I'd love to give people some direction if they're interested in following your work or if they want to get in touch, or what's the best way to follow you?
I guess just Google.
Google.
Yeah, I can't, I don't even follow myself. I get so lost. So, I mean, there's the past, there's the present, there's the future. I have a Wikipedia page even.
All right. Nice.
Which I guess has got more CV validity than say even a CV, but yeah, I enjoy teaching, mm-hmm. and it's great. We don't have any sort of community options for non-undergrad students to share in. But yeah, for my personal work, I'm working on a story now about the politics of nostalgia in Poland.
Okay.
And been there a few times. Even went to a few NATO bases when there was a big dust up with Russia, and sort of looking at how we make history into politics in the present.
Very interesting.
And yeah, fun stuff like that. Nationalism, that sort of thing. It was originally to be a cautionary tale, but oopsie.
And so
and the last story I did actually that it did about the Menlo Park Police Department, because
I heard this one.
Yeah, a bunch of students with them. And then while sitting at the dispatch, I was like, you're getting a lot of calls about Facebook, aren't you? And they're like, oh my God, yes. And so I went back and did a story about that.
Yeah, a nice little 3-minute piece, a little short one.
Yeah, that's what it was about. But I think there's a little reel about at the end, and I invite anyone to discover what that is.
On the Facebook one.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there's a longer version on PRX, which I make it much clearer and involves Public Ear Nation. So I would I would listen to that one.
So my last question, which we'll end the podcast on, I'm curious, what was something that you've heard? It could be a single episode or a full show or a radio piece you heard while driving into work or biking, as you said earlier. What's something that really, a story that really captured your imagination and has you excited about this craft and is inspiring you to do the work that you love to do?
Love and radio. Love and radio. That's all I have to say. When the new show drops, when they publish something, it's like, okay, it's like when a Harper's arrives in my post box, right? And stop everything. The Harper's is here. And Love and Radio, definitely.
And what about it?
Well, there are some hit and misses, but it's a slow chew. It is, as you describe, a close watch. You sit and you listen closely, because my experience is if you're not, you're going to regret it and you're going to have to go back and say, when did they get me? Because They got me. Mm-hmm. So Nick Vanderkolk is producer of that. He's just awesome.
What do you think? What do they do on Love and Radio that you feel like that's what I want to do? Like that's where I want to develop my game.
Yeah, craft and content. They use the medium itself in so many wonderful ways that we might say unique, but that aren't. And if you go back to the early days of NPR, there was a lot of sound experimentation. But to use the medium itself and transport us through degraded quality or through enhanced quality or manipulated quality, sometimes through actors, and that the line between fact and fiction, just like in real life, luckily, they flirt with and blur because that's how we live life. We immerse ourselves in so many fiction narratives, but really we use those as a way of understanding our world. So why not start flipping things around? Why not explore closer to that universal through every tool you have? And for them, they use sound really well. And for topic, Reply All is getting much better at taking one question and spending an entire episode leading up to that. In their tech desk scenario where they read a tweet saying, what does this mean? They can spend 40 minutes and we've gone to places we've never thought we would ever go and learn things that we didn't think were important, but really inform where we are today. So that's what I'm excited
all
about.
All right. We'll check those out to our listeners.
And of course, the Austin Meyer podcast.
I know, I was so shocked that it wasn't on like everyone's 2018 best of podcasts list. I was pretty upset by that. But hey, we're just starting out. We'll be there one day.
All right.
Jake, thank you so much for joining the show. I really appreciate it. I learned a ton, and I hope the audience enjoyed it as well. So thank you.
My pleasure. Do good work.
There you have it. Episode 12 of the Austin Meyer podcast is in the books. I had a really great time talking to Jake. You can tell just how deeply he cares and thinks about storytelling. And even though we may disagree on which is the best medium to tell stories, I hope I get a chance to collaborate with him one day. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend who is also interested in storytelling. I'm trying to get the word out about the show, but as you know, there are a lot of podcasts out there, so it's hard to get on people's radars, which is why your help means the world to me. And along those lines, please consider rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts, which helps the show's visibility. And last thing, if you want to help this show keep on going, if you want to join a community of amazing storytellers, if you want to be able to throw questions into the mix for guests like Jake for future episodes, please consider joining my new Patreon page. Patreon, if you don't know, is a membership platform that makes it easier for artists and creators to get paid for their work. And for as little as $1 per month, you'll not only get great perks, but you'll also help me continue to create this podcast, my documentary films, and all the other stories I'm coming out with each day. So if you're interested, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms for more information. That's it for me. Hope your 2019 is off to a great start. Now go out and tell some stories.